Welcome to our monthly Q&A with Kim and Jim. This month, they tackle the controversial field of evolutionary psychology, what science has discovered about the brains of non-human apes, whether large language models like ChatGPT could ever achieve true general intelligence, and much more. If you have a question you'd like answered in a future Q&A, you can send your question to mindingthebrainpodcast@gmail.com. We hope you enjoy the episode and look forward to answering more of your questions.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Minding the Brain, another question and answer with Kim and Jim we have today. We have questions that you have emailed in, and we are going to answer a bunch of them for you. First one I will take, it is from Priya. Priya asks if large language models like ChatGPT could ever lead to artificial general intelligence. So I'll just clarify this question for people who don't maybe know all those words. But ChatGPT, which I'm assuming you know what it is, it is an example of a large language model. So that ChatGPT and Claude and Gemini are all examples of large language models. So they're artificial intelligences that are made to produce text. And AGI, which is artificial general intelligence, is the state at which an artificial intelligence is as intelligent as a person in all the important ways. Now, what that what those ways actually are is a matter of some debate, but I think a lot of us have just sort of an intuitive idea that something like C-3PO from Star Wars is generally intelligent. So the question is, could these large language models lead to this general intelligence? And I think that in many ways they have, and what I mean by that is that many of the things that we would call upon a generally intelligent person to do, these large language models can already help. So I think that many of us find that talking to ChatGPT is often as good or better than emailing somebody and getting an answer back from them. They give results that look like reasoning. Whether or not it's actually reasoning, I think is maybe a philosophical point. But I think that there are some things that they can't do yet. And the question is, will they ever be able to do those things? So one thing that I am fairly confident they will never be able to do is be able to do fine motor coordination. So there's an enormous amount of knowledge that is embedded in text. Okay. And that's what these large language models have access to. Anything ever written down, they've read. One estimate is that it would take a person 2,000 or 3,000 years to read everything that ChatGPT was trained on. Okay. So there's a lot in there. There's a lot of knowledge in there, but people don't tend to write about certain things. For example, the way that you move all of your individual muscles to do a breaststroke, that is not written down anywhere. And so it is unlikely that just by using what the AI has learned from text, would it be able to control a robot to swim? Okay. So, you know, whether or not you consider swimming a part of artificial general intelligence is one of those things that is debated, right? Does it need to actually be able to control an embodied body to count as AGI, right? And some say yes, some say no, okay? My personal holy grail for a robotic AI is one that could put an IV in an uncompliant patient. Kim's impressed.
Yes, having seen some of that be dramatized on a show I'm watching right now, which is called The Pit, I can only imagine.
Yeah. So, just to be able to put in an IV in a willing patient is hard enough.
Oh, gosh.
Uncompliant patient without hurting them requires social knowledge. It requires theory of mind. It requires a very careful motor control. And that is, it's very hard to imagine how a large language model might be able to get the knowledge it needs to be able to perform such a task from text. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, if ChatGPT was augmented with some other kind of learning, right? Maybe we develop artificial intelligence that can watch videos and learn from videos. That's a totally different thing. But to the extent that it's learning from watching a video, it is not a large language model. That is an aspect of the AI that is functioning in a different way. Okay. Personally, I don't see that happening, but what most people want out of an AGI, it already can do a lot. Another big problem is that right now, these large language models are severely constrained by the size of their context window. And this is an important concept for people who use large language models a lot. I talked to one student who wanted help ChatGPT to help her with her fantasy world. So she said, I'm putting in all the stuff about my fantasy world over time. And I said, that doesn't work because it forgets about four, after you put in about four or five pages, it starts forgetting what was previous. That's the size of the context window, okay? And this is very frustrating. If you've ever gone back and forth with ChatGPT trying to solve something over a long period of time, you might have seen that it actually starts forgetting the beginning of the conversation. Mm-hmm. And people who've like started having boyfriends and girlfriends with ChatGPT and having relationships, they get disturbed sometimes when it's like, what do you mean you don't remember the name of my first boyfriend? I told you that, you know. The context window is actually quite small compared to what we would want a generally intelligent person to do. And this puts a lot of constraints on what it's able to do. It's right now, they can't really solve gigantic projects. Come up with a big project and manage it over the course of months. Like that is not really within the capability of what large language models can do. However, this limited context window, I'm not sure is necessarily a permanent constraint on large language models. What I mean by that is we might be able to come up with technologies that basically get rid of the context window problem, but we'd still be using large language models. Okay, so that might be overcome by an LLM like ChatGPT. How much is like ChatGPT if we get rid of the context window is an open question. But I think you could potentially do some very interesting large projects, run businesses, develop products just with large language models in a way that you couldn't with more physical stuff that has to be done in the real world. Kim, do you have anything to add or questions about that?
No, it's mind-boggling, really. You definitely spend a lot more time thinking about these things than I do. So yeah, I got nothing.
Okay, so we've got our next question is from Rachel and we're gonna have Kim answer it. Could we ever erase traumatic memories? Okay, and if so, should we do it? Let's hear what you have to say, Kim.
Yeah, so this is a great question. And the short answer is not exactly, but we might be able to modify traumatic memories. And it's really important to recognize that memory is highly distributed in the brain. It's not like we have just one population of cells that encode or hold the trauma memory. There's a lot of redundancy built in the brain, and there's a lot of components of memories, right? So we have episodic components, right? The feeling of like your personal experiences within that memory. Right? Our memory of the location, the faces around it, et cetera. We also have the semantic components, so the naming of elements of that memory. And then there's also, of course, the emotional component of memory. And what I would say is neuroscientists have really done a lot of great strides in research in understanding how we encode memories and therefore how we can manipulate them potentially. So I'm going to talk about two of my favorite scientists in this space. And one is Paul Franklin, who actually just came to Carleton to give a colloquium. So the timing of this is perfect. And Paul Franklin, who's at U of T, and his amazing wife as well, Sheena Jocelyn, have done incredible work in understanding what are called memory engrams. So what they've shown is that memories are encoded in specific neural ensembles or engrams. And he's used really advanced molecular biological techniques to be able to tag when certain populations of cells become active when a memory is encoded. So, for example, they might do simple experiment where they train a rat to learn that a specific sound is associated with a foot shock. So they can listen to certain cells in the brain that become active when that memory is encoded to learn, oh, that foot shock is associated with that specific sound. And so what he's also shown is that these memories can be reactivated and or suppressed. But his work has also shown that forgetting is a very active process. And how he's done this is he's actually shown, so like I said, he can tag which populations of cells are active when an animal is learning to or encoding a memory. And then he can do what's called an extinction paradigm, where you play the tone without the foot shock, tone without the foot shock, tone without the foot shock, and the animal stops freezing in response to the tone, so presumably has forgotten or isn't responding in the same way. And then what he can do is artificially stimulate those cells that encoded the memory, and he can show a reinitiation of that foot shock. So it's a really fascinating series of research that shows that these traumatic memories, for example, the foot shock, can be silenced, but again, not necessarily erased. And another person that I want to mention is Kareem Nader from McGill, another brilliant neuroscientist. And his work is actually presumably the inspiration for the movie Endless Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. If you haven't seen it, go out and see it. It's amazing. And his work suggests that memories are not as stable as we once thought. Every time we recall a memory, it enters a so-called labile state, meaning it becomes temporarily unstable and it can be modified before it's stored again. So you can imagine that this has major implications for treating PTSD. And in fact, Kareem Nader and several colleagues that have since picked up a lot of his trains and threads of his work now are trying to reduce the emotional component of that memory when it becomes that it enters that labile state. Because you can imagine with PTSD, maybe we can still have the memory of the episodic and the semantic memory of that traumatic event, but to be able to reduce the emotional component, well, that would be wonders for folks that are suffering with PTSD. So Nader's work, along with studies looking at things like beta blockers, if you've heard of propranolol, it's typically used in the treatment of heart disease where you're pumping out too much blood and you have high blood pressure. Beta blockers, which are these receptors are located in your heart, they're also located in your brain, actually prevent adrenaline from circulating in the bloodstream and therefore the brain. And what they've done is shown that if traumatic memory is reactivated under certain conditions, so for example, in therapy, it might be weakened or even reconsolidated in a less distressing form. So this is the basis of a lot of experimental PTSD treatments that pair the memory reactivation with drugs or behavioral interventions. So you can see, again, we're weakening the memory, but we're not necessarily eliminating it completely. So it's not like deleting a file. That doesn't tend to happen in the brain, but we can interfere with how it's stored, reducing its emotional weight. And if you want to check out our recent episode on psychedelics, there's now emerging research that shows that techniques like exposure therapy, reconsolidation-based therapy, and in conjunction with or separate with administration of psychedelics like MDMA can all leverage this notion of memory plasticity. Regarding your last question, should we erase traumatic memories? I love that you've asked that, because what's the point of having a memory store of something that's highly awful? It's a way the brain learns, or when we learn as organisms, to avoid things that could threaten our survival. So it's a really great theoretical and thought experiment to suggest, like, what if we were able to erase all our traumatic memories, which is sort of the basis of Endless Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. We can see that it actually serves an evolutionary purpose. Of course, we want to reduce the psychological impact of that trauma, and that's why the research is going in that direction. But we always want to make sure that we remember when things are bad and when things make us feel terrible or have a threat in our survival. So I would say probably not.
Oh, I would disagree. I would say probably should.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I think from what I've read of trauma, it's so debilitating, and it's not like you need to be brutally beaten to know that you need to avoid being beaten, you know. So
what if you were in a relationship with somebody who is terribly abusive, and then you erase that memory, and then you met that person again and entered the relationship all over again?
Yeah, that would be bad, but I think that would be rare compared to all the good we do. I think it'd be interesting to see, you know. But you might even make it not allowed in those cases, right? But if the people are broken up and there's no, you know, nobody's trying to get back together with anybody, and there's just a whole lot of awful memories, I mean, I think there'd be a lot of people who'd certainly want to do it.
Have you seen Endless Sunshine of the Spotless Mind?
Yes, I have.
And you saw where that went.
Do you think that's a realistic? Do you think that's what would happen in real life?
I don't know. There was a lot of sci-fi in there. I don't know. But also think about societal trauma, right? Do we want to erase, you know, now I'm thinking like really, you know, science fiction here, but erase war, our experiences of war and pandemics, right? Don't we learn from these experiences?
Yeah. And so I think that that, you know, looking at trauma as a learning experience is,
I know,
true, but you know, I don't know. It'd be very interesting to see. I would hope that we wouldn't ban it outright. I would hope that we would try and see if some of these negative things that are postulated actually happen, you know? Yeah. But you know, some people are just, their lives are just ruined by their traumas, you know? And
yeah. Well, that's why I would advocate for removing the emotional component. So then you have just the abstract memory of this, but you don't experience the psychological, the debilitating effects.
That's, I mean, that also might reduce your ability to learn from it too.
Fair.
You know, so it's a great, but the fact that we're talking about it means it's a great question. So thank you so much for offering that one. Yes. I also want to bring up, I've been reading lately about memory suppression, mm-hmm. whereby there are studies showing that you can train people to associate a new memory with an old trigger. So memories get recalled when they're triggered by something. So if I say, you know, what's your mother's name? And your mother's name comes to mind. The cue or the trigger was my asking that question, and then something popped into your mind. Mm-hmm. Similarly, if you've were beaten up at a Italian restaurant and you smell pizza, you might remember that thing, right? So there are studies showing that you can, with deliberate practice, try to retrieve different memories every time those triggers happen, and it reduces the unwanted recall. Is it deleting the memory? No, it's not. But memories that are not as easily accessed almost does as much good if it's a memory that's really hurting your well-being.
Fair. All right. So now we're going to move to Jordan is asking a question about why do some people, I didn't know this, by the way, hate evolutionary psychology so much. Is it a pseudoscience? I did not know this.
Okay. Yeah. So let me just explain what evolutionary psychology is. Evolutionary psychology is regular old psychology, but the hypotheses are derived from evolutionary reasoning. Okay. So, and yes, it does have a very bad reputation. A lot of psychologists just dismiss it completely. I like to say, there's some bad experiments out there, but evolutionary psychology has a pretty good explanation for why we want to eat food. Now I will say that it is a field, it is a part of psychology that does have a lot of badly run experiments. It's not the only one. There are lots of subfields of psychology where people are just, for whatever reason, a little less rigorous. Mm-hmm. However, it's also very frustrating for psychologists because even the suggestion of an evolutionary reason for something, people find very persuasive. There was a very famous book called The Naked Ape, written by Desmond Morris. Mm-hmm. And I read that book back when I was in university. And it's incredibly persuasive. It is completely made up. It is all like, oh, people like, men like cleavage because it looks like a behind, you know, and or they're whatever. Like he just comes up, this is a whole book of just speculation. And it is very tempting to walk away from that book feeling like you understand why these psychological things are here. That's evolution. That's evolutionary psychological theorizing and hypothesizing, okay? But there's nothing inherently wrong with coming up with hypotheses from evolution. In fact, it's not really unscientific to come up with hypotheses for whatever you want. It could come from a dream. It could come from throwing the I Ching. It could come from pseudoscience, and it could come from religion. What makes it science is the hypothesizing of what would happen in experiments and doing experimental testing. Okay, so that's where you get variance. Some evolutionary psychological hypotheses are not tested at all. Some are tested badly, and some are tested really well. There's a lot of great work on evolutionary psychology out there, but there's enough bad stuff. And the news media and people like just soak it up so gullibly that I think it makes a lot of psychologists very frustrated. I'll also say a lot of the studies are about mate choice. So, how do women pick the guys that they want to be with and vice versa? It's less helpful when it comes to the kind of stuff I'm interested in, how do memories get retrieved? achieved and, you know, how do people make plans and this kind of thing. It doesn't have a whole lot to say about cognition sort of in general. One thing that it postulates, or some theorists do, that is more that the mind is less like a general purpose computer and more like a Swiss Army knife, where you've got a whole bunch of evolutionary adaptations sort of stuffed in, sometimes at odds with each other, and this and that. But you know, whether the mind is more like a Swiss Army knife or Swiss Army knife or a general purpose computer is sort of a judgment call anyway. So that's my answer to that.
Fair enough.
So next we got a question from Chris. This is a neuroscience question, so we're going to have our neuroscience expert, Kim, answer it. Chris asks, what has neuroscience learned about the brains of non-human apes? Of course, this could be an entire degree.
Indeed. There's a lot out there, Chris. So I was trying to figure out I think you were trying to learn more about or understand more about the brain in specific, but I'm going to talk about brain stuff and a little bit about cognition as well, because we have learned quite a bit compared to other primates. Chimpanzees, things like bonobos, gorillas, orangutans do have relatively larger brain size than what their body size would predict, if that makes sense. But humans still have 3 times the brain size of a chimpanzee. So relatively speaking, we're still considered, we have a larger brain relative to our body, and that's called the encephalization quotient. So we have a larger EQ relative to apes. And one thing that's important, of course, is they are our most closest relative, evolutionary speaking. And the part of the brain that we've talked a lot about in this podcast, the prefrontal cortex. Oh, I've got my, look, we can use these now.
Oh, we have props today. You're lucky enough to see Kim from her office. So
yeah. So this is a model of the human brain. Everything really, I should use this size here in orange, is your frontal lobe. And the very most anterior, so the very front part of the frontal lobe and the outermost layer of cells, it's called the prefrontal cortex. And this is the region of the brain that really, I would say, tends to differentiate humans from all other species on the planet, because we do have a fairly evolved prefrontal cortex. We have a lot of hardware devoted to planning, reasoning, decision-making, etc. And in apes, theirs is comparatively quite a bit smaller. So they still have a lot more advanced cognition relative to other species, and in particular other mammals. And so there is research that shows that apes have fairly sophisticated cognitive capabilities, in particular their ability to use tools. There's lots of cool videos of chimpanzees using sticks to get ants out of a hole in a log, right? So the use of these tools is considered a fairly advanced cognitive capability. I should mention as well, there's some species of birds that are able to do this. So corvids, crows in particular, very, very smart. Ravens, super smart. They have also been documented to have a lot of tool use. They also have excellent episodic and working memory. So I was just previously talking about episodic memory is your own personal memories for facts and events that relate to yourself. And working memory is due to the abilities of the frontal lobe. So that's kind of the best example of working memory is keeping a grocery list on hand when you walk into a grocery store. You're like milk, eggs, broccoli, cheese, etc. And studies have shown when you do what's called delayed matching to sample tasks with apes, so you present them press this key if you see this specific stimulus on this side of the screen, and press this key if you see this specific stimulus, and then you delay when you present the stimulus in a specific order. So you have to keep in mind, oh, did I see the stimulus here, or did I see the stimulus here? Apes, chimpanzees in particular, are very good at having that ability to keep their working memory going, to be able to localize where the stimulus is to get their, often it's like a orange juice reward. And they also have, apes have theory of mind. So I think we talked about this in the episode on autism, but theory of mind is the ability in humans to know that somebody else is having thoughts, emotions that are separate from yourself. So little children, like 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds, lack theory of mind. They tend to think, I'm sad, therefore my stuffed animal is sad and the moon is sad. So they attribute their own emotional state and their own mind state to external objects, even things that are not alive. And it comes around the age of 5 or 6, is that when we get theory of mind, and it's quite testable. And believe it or not, even in these species that do not have language or verbal language, you can actually test theory of mind. And apes do have this function, and it is linked to their the cells in your prefrontal, in their prefrontal cortex. They also pass the mirror test, which is, Jim, I'm sure you know what the mirror test is, you teach cognition. So if I put like a little sticky dot on my forehead, and you did that on, sorry, not me, but you put it on a baby, at a certain point, they would look in a mirror and they know this sticky dot is on my forehead. So it's this, their ability to know what I'm looking at is me. And you can do these mirror tests with all kinds of different species. And sure enough, apes will take off that little sticky dot. So they presumably...
Yeah, what that means is pretty controversial, but yeah.
Oh, some, really?
Yeah, I mean, some people think it means there's self-awareness, but, you know, even like... Octopuses can tell the difference between them and the environment. Like most animals can tell the difference between their body and the environment. Why isn't that enough for some kind of, you know, self-awareness? Like it, being able to understand how a mirror works is very specific and a little, people put a lot of credit into it, but it's not universally thought to be indicative of anything particularly important. Some people think it is though.
Well, look at me. I dipped into cognitive abilities.
You dipped into consciousness.
The question was about the brain, and I went into cognition. Anyway, long story short, they have large, complex brains. It's not quite like ours.